Good morning, Hope. My name is Davis. If I have not had the chance to meet you, I'm one of the pastors here at the downtown location. Did anybody else get caught driving in that storm yesterday? And any of the multiple storms, a few of you? Yeah, it was pretty wild. We were watching the radar on our way back from Brainerd, and it was like, you know, the green, and then it was yellow, and then orange, and then red, and then purple. We had never seen purple before while on a drive. It was pretty crazy, so we had to pull off to the side. That has nothing to do with anything this morning. I just was kind of blown away by the weather yesterday. Anyway, good to meet you. Good to see you guys this morning. This summer, my wife and I had a chance to visit Nashville, Tennessee to take a little vacation with her family, all the in-laws, and we all stayed in one Airbnb for that entire week with four kids under four. And it was, as we collectively agreed by the end of the trip, a trip, and it was not a vacation. We also were like, this was exhausting. But before that, my wife Em and I got to visit the Johnny Cash Museum in downtown Nashville. Anybody been here to the? Yeah, a few of you. Wild, loved this museum. Johnny Cash has some nostalgic value for me as one of my grandfathers, who's no longer with us, used to sing Johnny Cash songs, and he kind of had that raspy voice as well that matched Johnny. And so when we were given the opportunity, we didn't even know this was there. We were walking by it, and when we saw the price tag, we were like, yeah, it's fine. Just throw the money at it. It's fine. Let's take a tour of this museum. And it was wild. While walking through this museum of this man, we learned so much about this guy's history. Right when you walk in, there are these floor-to-ceiling just banners of every decade of his life, even since he was a boy all the way into his adulthood, which is wild if you think about it. Like, just imagine somebody doing that for your life, just banners, floor to ceiling of who this man or woman is, and you just walking through the contents of who they were and all their accomplishments and their achievements. I learned so many things that I did not know about Johnny Cash throughout this tour, but what blew me away about it is at the very end, after walking through all of his ups and downs of his life, and all the things he accomplished, at the very end, there's this little shrine of a music video he did, the very last music video he recorded, which was actually not an original song. It was a recording of a cover by Nine Inch Nails called Hurt. And it's an old Johnny Cash, and he's just sitting there in a chair with his guitar, weathered by life and weary, and he sings somebody else's song. And in this rendition of the song Hurt, he kind of changes the meaning of the lyrics a little bit, especially one of the most pronounced lyrics of the song, which is, "You can have it all, my empire of dirt. You can have it all, my empire of dirt." A weathered Johnny Cash looking you dead in the eyes as you had just walked through his whole life and all that he had done. Why am I telling you these things? Well, we are in our last message in the parables. It's been a very fun summer as we've been walking through the different messages of Jesus. And parables are a unique story that Jesus would tell where he'd often look at something and say, there's a bigger meaning here. I'm pointing to something over here so that you might hear what I have to say to you, to your heart, and to your circumstances that you have in your life. And we've covered a lot of parables, certainly not all of them, but some of the significant ones, from looking at finances to agriculture, and it feels like everything in between. And today, we're going to be talking about foundations, one of Jesus's more well-known parables, a very short parable that he had. And I bring up that Johnny Cash story because I want us to consider what it looks like to build a life that is unshakable, to build a life that at the end of your story, you can look into the camera or into your family or into whoever you have around you and not utter those words, that this was all for nothing, that this is an empire of dirt, that time has won the battle and none of this really matters. So we're going to hear from Jesus as we open up the parable of the wise and foolish builders. If you do have a Bible, I encourage you to open it up to Matthew 7. That's where we're going to be. Just a few short verses. I think it's four verses, and we're going to take it in stride. So these are Jesus's words. He says, "Therefore," starting in verse 24, "everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house. Yet it did not fall because it had its foundation on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against the house, and it fell with a great crash. Just four verses, and this is where I want us to go this morning. If you're more of the outline type and you like to have an idea of where are we going? Where are you taking us? I just want to look at the elements of the passage, the houses, the foundations, and the storms. And then at the very end, I want us to kind of consider, as we have subtitled this whole sermon series, Uncovering Good News. In other words, and as we've been looking at throughout the summer, there's a way to hear these parables, these messages, and to make them about us and kind of a job description or a to-do list. But I think Jesus has much more for us this morning. I think he has good news for everyone who walks into our church building this morning. Jesus is always in the business of giving away good news, a better word than our circumstances and our situations. And so that's what I want to do at the end of our message. So we'll start with the houses we build. There are two houses and two builders in the beginning of the passage. And right away, I just want us to see, Jesus is talking about you. He's talking about us. He's talking about human beings. Everybody is compared to a builder of a house. We all have our tool belts on and we're building something. Maybe some of us have never actually considered that. Like, just right now, the things that are the contents of your life can be compared to somebody who's building a house. Your vocation, your relationships, family, friends, hobbies, pastime, your church, the things you like to do. All of these things are kind of compared to building a life, building a house. What then is this house to be made of? What are we supposed to do in order to build a house that can withstand the test of time, as Jesus has been discussing? Well, we want to back up a little bit to this first line. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice. Our parable this morning is on the tail end of one of Jesus' most famous messages, maybe one of the Bible's most famous messages. It's called the Sermon on the Mount. It's Matthew 5 through 7. And in this sermon, Jesus does some amazing kind of smashing together of big ideas in the Old Testament. In preacher school, they often teach you to have kind of one big idea that you drive home and you kind of unpack it along the way. The Sermon on the Mount doesn't follow that guideline. Jesus zooms in on things like from the Old Testament, this law, and he analyzes it like an expert and says, you've heard it said, for example, that you should not commit adultery. But I say unto you that if you even think about that idea, you've committed adultery. So he looks at the law itself of God in the Old Testament, and he analyzes it in a way that had all of his hearers like, I have never heard it said or taught this way. But he also looks back at God's promises and brings them to bear on reality. He smashes these things together in an amazing fashion. So he says things like, blessed are the poor, and those who have nothing, they are the ones who are going to receive the kingdom of God. Throughout time, though, people have often tried to summarize this Sermon on the Mount, and famously, I think it wrongly sometimes gets summarized just into the Golden Rule. Now, if you grew up in public school, you probably heard some form of this golden rule. Probably wasn't quoted in the Bible. But do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Or if you went to my public school, you just heard it as do the right thing, right? Jesus' words about the golden rule kind of got turned into this form of do the right thing. And what happens when we do that, when we say that the contents of what we should build our life on is essentially do the right thing, we reduce Jesus' message and what he's trying to do here to the 1985 South Wales Government Litter Reduction Program. That's what this picture is. South Wales Government Litter Reduction Program in 1985. I'd never seen this until I was preparing this message, got into a little bit of a rabbit hole with this one. Watch the whole thing. Encourage you to watch it. It's quite something. This last image is a man standing next to a trash can that talks to people as they walk by. And they just record people being talked to by a trash can. And this last guy was my favorite. And this is how the whole commercial ends. He's just standing there reading his paper or something. And the trash can points out that you can see in the bottom left, there's a cup sitting there. And the trash can just says, hey, pick up that cup. And the guy goes, no, I'm not going to pick up this cup. And then the commercial just ends. It's like, I don't think that's very effective marketing. The trash can's not working. I don't know what's going on there. And I think Jesus has far more of a message for us than just a talking trash can, of just do the right thing. I think Jesus understands what is within us that even causes us to say to something that's good, like don't litter, No. No, I don't want to do that. I don't even want you to tell me what to do. In fact, in John 2, while people are starting to follow Jesus and receive his message, it says this: Jesus would not entrust himself to the people around him. He did not need any testimony about mankind, for he knew what was in each person. In other words, Jesus has eyes to see what's underneath the surface of all human beings. He can see the unseen things, which is a great metaphor for how this book even works, this Bible, this Word of God. And here in this passage, we're talking about unseen things. We're not talking even about the building materials of the house. We're instead comparing that which the eyes can't see, that of the foundations. Jesus wants us to zoom in on what it is we're building our lives on. He's shining a spotlight into this realm, into this area that we cannot see with our eyes. He's taking us to the place that, if you know a good real estate agent, when you walk into a house, what do they say? Good bones, right? Like, that's where Jesus wants us to see. What makes up a good bones house? The things that you cannot see with your eyes. And they're compared to, the two foundations are a solid rock and sinking sand. And notice in particular, it doesn't have anything to do with what is on those foundations. It doesn't have to do with the size, the quality of the materials, the skill of the builder itself. What makes all the difference is the foundations on which it is built. That picture on the right always makes me laugh every time I look up something, house on sinking sand. It's like, how many different ways can a house fall on itself? 11, apparently. So starting with the solid rock, I want us to hear a little bit from the Old Testament about what does this solid rock look like. And Abraham was a guy that we learned, if you were around this last season when we walked through the book of Hebrews, he was a guy that looked forward to a foundation, a city that had God's fingerprints on it within the foundation. We heard in Hebrews 11 that Abraham was looking forward to the city with foundations whose architect and builder is God. And it made all the difference in his life. You couldn't see that foundation that he was looking forward to, but if you watch the arc of his life, there's a change that happens and he starts to live differently as a result of looking to, trusting in something that his eyes could not see, but the word that he heard from the Lord. Isaiah, a prophet in the Old Testament, picks up on this theme and says this about a foundation that is sturdy, a foundation that is strong. He says, so this is what the sovereign Lord says. See, I lay a stone in Zion, a tested stone, a precious cornerstone for a sure foundation. The one who relies on it, that stone, will never be stricken with panic. Edward Young, a Isaiah commentator and scholar, says this about this passage. What is the foundation stone of which the prophet speaks? This thing that he can't even see, he doesn't even have all the pieces yet. But he speaks of the stone that God lays. The thought is that God has implanted firmly and deeply in the earth a stone which cannot easily be moved, and upon which one may build a house with perfect safety. Of importance is the past tense, for the stone has already been laid in the ground, and inasmuch as there is laid a firm foundation, it is mere folly to place one's confidence in a foundation not firmly laid. What does it look like to place one's confidence in a foundation not firmly laid? I think there's a lot of ways to approach answering that question, to think about foundations of sinking sand. The verse from Proverbs that came to my mind while reading this passage this week is, there's a way that appears to be right. Like when you just think about, what am I to do with my life? Where should I go? The Proverbs say, in the end, it leads to death. There's a way that's intuitive and says, this is what I should do. But in the end, it leads to destruction, utter undoing, and becoming obsolete. So there's a lot of different foundations of sand that I think are available to us as those who live here in 2021 in the Twin Cities. But I just want to highlight three of them this morning with us. The first is what we might call a foundation of performance. A foundation of performance sounds and looks like, at the end of the day, I can hang my hat on that which I achieve. That's that which I accomplish. When everything else hits the fan, I can at least look at what I've done with my life and be proud of it. I think Johnny Cash is a good example as to why we probably shouldn't be trusting that as a foundation. This is another picture from that museum, and I just did a little research on this guy's accolades, right? 11 Grammys, 3 times entered into different Hall of Fames. He was given a National Medal of Honor for something. I don't know why would Johnny Cash be given that? He was not only a singer and a songwriter, but he was an actor and a film producer. He was a country music legend, according to, and this is a real thing, the Academy of Achievement. It's a real thing that you can Google. The Academy of Achievement says this guy is a country music legend, a legend in his field. And at the end of it all, he was the one that looked into camera and said, "You can have it all. All of these achievements that I have accounted for in my life are not sturdy enough to withstand the weight of even one eternal soul. All these things I look back on, yes, I'm proud of them, not bad things." But he just says, "You can have it all, my empire of dirt." Another form of a foundation of performance might not be achievement. I think some of us in the room would maybe identify less with that of like, I don't really care about what I achieve in life. But what I do care about is my work ethic. At the end of the day, I don't care what I get for it, but I'm going to put my nose down. I'm going to work to the grindstone. Come hell or high water, I'm going to work hard. And that's what I'm going to build my life on. Whatever you give me, I'm going to return it with fire. I'm going to return it with effort. I'm going to return it with, I got this. 5 years ago, I first started reading the Alcoholics book, the big book, the Alcoholics Anonymous, Alcoholics book, no, Alcoholics Anonymous, the big book, they call it. And I had some close friends going through some different forms of struggle with addiction and alcoholism. And I've kept that book close. I mean, it's a resource that as I've been in ministry, I've turned to regularly and learned not only about people suffering with an outward form of addiction, but just about the anatomy of the human soul. Because so much of what's in that book actually serves as a map of all of us and the many forms of addiction that all of us have and how level playing field it really is at the end of the day with the ways that we all struggle with things that just say, be my one thing, be that foundation upon which I can build my life. I think the more common forms of addiction for us nowadays are things like entertainment and distraction. But as I was thinking about this foundation of performance this week and this idea of being self-sufficient and working hard, I reread step 3, and I just want to share one little section from that step 3 about why building a foundation upon your efforts, your abilities, truly is sand in the long run. It says this: how persistently we claim the right to decide all by ourselves just what we shall think and just how we shall act. Oh yes, we'll weigh the pros and cons of every problem. We'll listen politely to those who would advise us, but all the decisions are to be ours alone. Nobody is going to meddle with our personal independence in such matters. Besides, we think there is no one we can surely trust. We are certain that our intelligence, backed by willpower, can rightly control our inner lives and guarantee us success in the world we live in. It goes on. This brave philosophy, wherein each man plays God, sounds good in the speaking, but it still has to meet the acid test. How well does it actually work? One good look in the mirror ought to be answer enough for anyone. Should his own image in the mirror be too awful to contemplate, and it usually is, love that ad, he might first take a look at the results normal people are getting from self-sufficiency. Everywhere he sees people filled with anger and fear, society breaking up into warring fragments, each fragment says to the others, "We are right and you are wrong." Every such pressure group, if it is strong enough, self-righteously imposes its will upon the rest. And everywhere, the same thing is being done on an individual basis. The sum of all this mighty effort is less peace and less brotherhood than before. The philosophy of self-sufficiency is not paying off. Plainly enough, it is a bone-crushing juggernaut whose final achievement is ruin. I love that last sentence. At the end of the day, this idea that I am captain of my own ship, I am master and commander of my life, and I will just work hard, leads to ruin and ruin alone in the long run. A foundation of performance, achievement, or self-sufficiency truly is a foundation of sand, not sturdy enough to build your life on. A second one is what we might call a foundation of intellect.
That which you believe and think about the world, is that sturdy enough to build your very life on? This one's a little bit more insidious. Often it works like this in us. My thoughts are good and they are true. What I believe about the world is true and it's good. Next step below that, at the end of the day, I kind of am what I think, what I believe. And the connection between the two is I am good because of these beliefs. It's one of the surest ways to self-righteousness is by just that line of just what I think is good and true. And I am those things. Therefore, I am good and true. I am righteous because of what I think about the world. Tim Keller's helpful on why there's no such thing as a foundation of the intellect. He says this, this world, plainly enough, has no intellectual foundations. No human philosophy will even last. What's extraordinarily clear is that things that were written in the New York Times or any other newspaper on the editorial page 20 years ago are now seen as hateful, obscene, primitive, horrible stuff 20 years ago. Do you think we've arrived at the ultimate moment now? Do you think that somehow 20 years from now, everybody will read the stuff that's in the New York Times and say, isn't it wonderful how brilliant? We finally arrived at the right views. No. He goes on. In fact, let me be personal. There are things that right now you and I believe as an enlightened persons that two generations from now, they will be risible, meaning like laughable, absurd, embarrassing. Anyone who is related to you will be upset that you even put it down on paper. There are no intellectual foundations here. No human philosophies will last. It's not just that they sort of develop, they become obsolete. They become stupid. You give your whole life to building your life on the basis of a set of beliefs. They're going to go away. All human philosophies have no foundation. And if you think about it again, in the analogy of a house, a foundation that only lasts 20 years for a house is absurd. We cannot build our lives on a foundation of the intellect. It will expire, and it will expire soon. Last one I have for us this morning is a foundation of what we might call association. A foundation of the people that I identify with, my family, my friends, that group I'm a part of, fill in the blank. Who are your tribe? If this is the foundation of our life, we start to sound a lot like Vin Diesel in The Fast and the Furious. Any fans of The Fast and the Furious out there? Come on. They have like, when does a franchise become a universe like Marvel? Because I think we're getting close to that with Fast and the Furious. They just keep cranking them out. And I love these movies. I grew up on a lot of these movies, especially the first two. We're always quoted in our house growing up. And I was amazed as I thought through a foundation of association this week, how many times they talk about family being the basis of everything they do in this movie. Everything they do in this series. Everything comes down to family. And this was the second and last rabbit trail I went down this week. But wow, people are creative on the internet. Like if you think gravity doesn't matter, you can't. You can think that because Vin Diesel does. This is not how gravity works. Doesn't matter. Something here is bigger than gravity and that's family. That's the association, right? Or this one was my favorite. If you think the Google password is weak, correct it with family. Underneath it all, you got family. There are so many different ways to see a foundation of association in our life. And there are two huge problems with this, with any tribe that we say, at the end of the day, at least I'm a part of this group. The first one is that the goalposts might move for that group that we're a part of. And as the goalposts move, like a new first down in a football game, if you're not moving with it, you're out of the group. That's the first danger of having a foundation of association. The second one, though, and this is more common, more universal, is that it just will become obsolete. Listen to the psalmist. The life of mortals is like grass. They flourish like a flower in the field. The wind blows over it. Like, what's the thing that ends this? What's the thing that ends human beings? The wind. The softest thing. Not like yesterday's storm, but just like a nice gust of wind, and the wind blows over it, and it is gone. And its place remembers it no more. Even the place that held human beings remembers it no more, because it's just new people. This last one, this foundation of association, is the one that hit a little bit more close to home for me in my own story. Like we often talk about here at Hope, for some of us, the story is like a light switch just turning on, right? When you first hear about God and his act for you through his son, Jesus, it's like, I had no idea this happened and I'm in, both feet. For others of us, it's more like a light dimmer, where maybe we heard this message before and it just starts to get brighter throughout time until maybe some moments along the story where it just gets brighter and brighter and brighter. And for me, the foundations of association being eroded, especially when I was in college, was significant for these lights to just get way, way brighter in my life. There was a time in college when my grandfather, actually that grandfather that loved Johnny Cash, he passed away very unexpectedly of a heart attack. A relationship that I was in for a long time that I thought was gonna last forever just ended on a dime. And then the friend group I was a part of, that I thought, again, these are the lifelong friends that you hear about, eroded in a matter of weeks, what felt like weeks. And it all seemed to happen at the same time. And I found myself at a Hope service, and we were singing, I think it was Beautiful Things. And I saw some people with their hands in the air, and again, I was kind of a Christmas and Easter Christian growing up, so this was unfamiliar to me. I was the variety that thought, that person has a question, and that's a weird place to raise your hand during a worship service. But when these three pillars were knocked out underneath me, and I didn't even know they were pillars in my life until they were gone, until I thought, wow, the things I were building my life on are no longer here. What is my life even about? And I saw again, people just raising their hand and it clicked. The reason the hands are going up is because worship is taking place here. People are reaching out to the foundation that lasts. That promise, like we saw in Isaiah, of one reaching out because God placed the foundation that cannot be shaken as easily as these three pillars fell out from my own. And so in that moment, I'm like, both hands, windshield wiper, like, let's go, Jesus. I was in. The lights got a lot brighter in that moment. Foundations of association coming to an end. And isn't that the role of the storm in this passage? The role of the storm is to reveal foundations that are shoddy, foundations that cannot hold things over the course of time. It reveals foundations of sand, the things that we're building our lives on. And in a strange way, it's kind of a mercy of God. Psalm 29 talks about this, that when sometimes storms, different forms of suffering and crisis that happen to us can be allowed by God, doesn't mean he's always the source of these things, as a mercy to reveal these foundations upon which we're building our life that cannot withstand the test of time, that cannot hold the weight of your eternal soul. And so sometimes he allows storms to come. And he is king over these storms. He's sitting down during the storms. He is not intimidated by them. One of the instances where we see all of these things come to a head is in the Gospel of Mark, where foundations are revealed and the need for a sturdy foundation is given, this foundation of the rock. How do we find that foundation that is on the rock? It happens when a group of Jesus and his disciples are out at sea and they're on a boat when a storm comes up. Or a squall in Mark's gospel. We should bring that word back, squall. She described yesterday's storm with that. Squall, use that this week. All right, a furious squall came up and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" Right, the disciples are seeing this storm that's threatening their lives and they're waking Jesus up, kind of saying, how dare you sleep? You're the one that we're trusting in, and you don't even care if we perish? You don't even care if we drown? Now, to those familiar at all with the Old Testament, this scene looks very familiar, where you have a group of individuals who are in a boat, and they're fearful for their lives, and down in the bottom of the deck, there lies one asleep, unintimidated, by the storm. It's the story of Jonah. Jonah was asleep in the boat when everyone came down and woke him up in the midst of a storm. He had been running from God, and God sent a storm after him and the sailors that were hosting him. And they came and woke him up and said, "Don't you care if we perish? Come and call on your God," who's different than our God at that time, "and see what he can do for us." Picks up in verse 11. This is Jonah 1, verse 11, not Jonah 11, verse 11. There's no such thing as Jonah 11. That's a typo. Jonah 1, verse 11 to 16. It says this, the sea was getting rougher and rougher. So they asked him, what should we do to you to make the sea calm down for us? Here's Jonah's response, super intuitive, right? Pick me up and throw me into the sea. To a group of sailors, mind you, right? And then it will become calm. I know that it is my fault that this great storm has come upon you. What should we do, Jonah, to stop the storm? Take me and throw me into it. To a group of professional sailors who have done this for a living and have been in so many storms, right? Of course they've been in storms. This is what they do. And so they hear this and they go, that is an amazing idea. Let's do that. No, of course not. What does it say? Instead, the men, the sailors, did their best to row back to land. Pause. This is a picture of every single one of us in a storm. When the storm rises, we look for the oar and we go, I need to get myself to safety. Jonah doesn't let us get away with that. What is the very next sentence? But they could not, for the storm, the sea, grew even wilder than before. The moment the men try to take their rescue into their own hands, the storm itself starts to grow, gets even worse, gets even more wild, so that they're brought to the end of themselves and they say, hey, that counterintuitive thing that he suggested, let's try that. So they cry out to the Lord, please, Lord, do not let us die for taking this man's life. Do not hold us accountable for killing an innocent man. It's interesting. He's not innocent. He just told you he's not innocent. For you, Lord, have done as you please. Then they took Jonah and they threw him overboard, and the raging sea grew calm. At this, the men greatly feared the Lord, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord for the first time and made vows to him. At this counterintuitive event, where one was sacrificed for the many, the storm ceases, and these men, these sailors, a group of sailors, begin to praise God for the very first time. So when we jump back into Mark's story, where Jesus is asleep on the bow, what do we expect? When a group of sailors wake up the sleeping prophet and say, don't you care if we perish? There's an expectation here that, are we gonna see Jesus get thrown into the storm right now? Is this gonna happen? What happens? No. He goes up, rebukes the wind, and says to the waves, quiet, be still. Then the wind dies down and it was completely calm. Our expectations are not fulfilled yet. Jesus is not jumping into this storm. Instead, with his voice, like the author of Psalm 29 points out, like God, he says, no, no more. We're done with this storm. And he causes the winds to be quiet. Because soon the winds are going to build again, but this time the winds are going to be much greater. And this time the context of who is going to be saved is not a group of sailors, but the whole world. Jesus is not jumping into this storm yet because there's a greater storm that he's going to be thrown into. In his own mind and ministry, Jesus says to his disciples, something greater than Jonah is here. There is a greater storm upon which I am going to climb out of the boat and into the sea so that the storm will cease, but not just for a small group, for the whole world. Jesus climbed down from heaven to face the storm of heaven for you and for me and for all who would come and believe, who would come and look at the counterintuitive solution to the greatest of problems and watch it work so that we might begin to praise God. Jesus is the rock in our passage today. He is the one who endured the ultimate storm, was beaten and battered for our sake, for your sake, that you might look this morning and believe, that you might build a life on the counterintuitive solution to the ultimate storm. Isaiah elsewhere promised that the ones who wanted to have righteousness to seek the Lord, and where are they to look? Look to the rock, to which the New Testament authors look back on and say the rock has always been Christ. Even before he was seen, even before he took on flesh and died for the world, it's always been Jesus. And the counterintuitive message of his sacrifice for all. This is what Samuel Ngewa, an African scholar, says about this metaphor of a stone, a rock, Jesus as the ultimate rock upon which we can build. This metaphor also emphasizes the ownership of the church. It belongs to God, not people. Hope Community Church, we belong to God, not to people. Jesus is both its foundation and the chief cornerstone, the stone that controls the design of the whole building. This principle of one coming underneath and laying down his life that all might live is the very principle, the very design of the building. And it's sturdy enough for all of us to build our lives so that we might say with the most famous Spurgeon quote I think that exists, and everybody's put it on a different form of Pinterest. I love that. It's good. I have learned, Spurgeon says, to kiss the wave that throws me against the rock of ages. You can only say this if the ultimate storm has been taken away, because nothing is now permanent as a result of Jesus taking your permanent separation from God onto his own shoulders and coming back to life. Now we can kiss the wave. When suffering comes, we can greet it and say, God has purposes for me, even if I can't see them. And all of us are either coming out of a storm, enduring a storm, or heading into a storm of some kind. And the gospel teaches us to say, something bigger than me is happening, and I'm going to entrust myself unto the one who died for me. And the parts of my life that are not built upon this rock will crumble, and that will be a mercy of God, so that I might rebuild that part of my life on the rock. And it's not even me about discovering the rock. It's about Jesus grafting you onto it, taking you here, that you might learn to build upon his foundation. I just got two questions for us as we wrap up today's message. Where are you building in your life on a foundation of sand? It's probably not your whole life. There are probably parts of it. For those of us who said yes to Jesus in some form or fashion, there are still parts of our lives that are at risk of eroding as time and storms build. And lastly, who is someone that might just need to hear about this rock of ages? This one who has been promised in ancient times and fulfilled on the rock of Calvary, where the Prince of Glory died for you, that you might have life. Let me pray. Jesus, thank you for your word, which is steadfast and true and solid. Christ, thank you that you took on our ultimate storm and that you climbed out of heaven to climb across in our place, to be thrown into our storms, the storms that we could not endure, that we might have life everlasting. Lord, I pray that you would help us to identify those places within us that we are building on a foundation of sand, that we might turn again, we might turn back to you and find beneath us the sturdy ground of the cross upon which you died and upon which you came back to life forever and ever. Lord, thank you for this series in the parables. I pray, God, that you would call these things to mind through the power of your Spirit, that we might be a different people as a result of our time together in your word this summer. Pray these things, trusting you, Jesus. In your name, amen.